From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Two years ago, Albie Sachs survived an assassination attempt. He lost an arm in a car bomb explosion, but his belief survived intact. On today's Fresh Air, the exiled white South African discusses his work with the African National Congress. Also today, the Looney music from Looney Tunes. We talk with the producers of a new recording featuring music composed by Carl Stalling for Warner Brothers cartoons. Rock historian Ed Ward casts his ballot for this year's nominees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Pump Up the Volume. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 165 Americans arrived in Amman, Jordan today, brought out of Iraqi-occupied Kuwait in a U.S.-chartered Iraqi jet. It was the largest evacuation of Americans since Iraqi President Saddam Hussein announced that women and children would be free to go. The returning women and children described a scene of terror and chaos in Kuwait, where most were forced to leave husbands and fathers behind. Many foreign men have reportedly been scattered at key Iraqi installations to act as human shields in the event of attack by U.S.-led forces. Officials in Jordan are reportedly planning to close their refugee camps set up along the desert border with Iraq because of squalid, chaotic conditions there. More than 40,000 refugees from Iraq and Kuwait, mostly Asians, are stuck in the camps. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Amman.
The camp in the desert sprang up within the past few weeks as thousands of foreigners, mostly guest workers, streamed out of Iraq and Kuwait to escape the threat of war. Jordanian authorities stopped allowing the foreigners to cross the border because their governments weren't moving rapidly enough to repatriate them. But there were no facilities for sheltering the refugees in the brutal desert conditions. Food and water are in dangerously short supply, and there are no latrines. Jordanian authorities have been working on a new refugee camp where conditions should be better, and this week the deputy interior minister here told visitors that the border camp would be closed. But that won't happen until the new camp is ready, and water problems have delayed its opening for several days. Jordanian officials have appealed for international help to deal with the refugees. The European Economic Community says it will contribute about $30 million. In Amman, I'm Tom Gelton.
A Lebanese magazine says that 15 Shiite prisoners held in Kuwait have been released by the Iraqis and handed to Iran. The release was one of the demands of kidnappers holding Westerners hostage in Lebanon, fueling speculation that more Westerners will be freed soon. Gerald Butt has more from Nicosia.
The report about the fate of the 15 Shiites has been published by Ashira magazine in Beirut. It's a journal which has generally proved to be well informed on matters relating to hostages. In 1984, a group of Shiites in Kuwait were jailed for having been involved in bombings in the country. The Islamic Holy War Organization in Lebanon took a number of Westerners hostage with the specific aim of winning the freedom of the prisoners. After the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait 5 weeks ago, Western intelligence sources in the Middle East said they had information that the 15 Shiite prisoners had been whisked away to Baghdad by Iraqi troops. Ashira magazine now says the 15 Shiites have been handed over to Iran. So the way would seem to be clear for them to be returned to Lebanon, thus meeting the demand of the Islamic Holy War Organization and, in theory, clearing the way for the freeing of hostages. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
The Dow gained 23 points today to close at 2,619. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 2 years ago, South African lawyer Albie Sachs opened his car door and a bomb explosion threw him 30 feet in the air. Sachs is a longtime anti-apartheid activist. He was among the first whites to join the African National Congress and remains a member of the ANC's Constitutional and Legal Department. He now lives in London, but just returned this week from a visit to South Africa. Sachs survived the car bomb attack, but he lost an arm and most of the sight in his left eye. He still has nerve problems in one foot and continues to find bits of shrapnel in his body. He writes about his recovery in his new memoir, Running to Maputo. Maputo is in Mozambique, where Sachs was living in exile at the time of the explosion. I asked him to reconstruct what happened during the assassination attempt.
Well, I didn't know it was an assassination attempt until afterwards, so I have to reconstruct not for you but for myself, and that was part of what writing it all was about. I can just remember something terrible was happening to me. I sort of blacked out. Everything was dark. I was swaying. And I felt a huge, like a punch against the back of my neck. And I thought I'd banged my head on something, like when I used to climb Table Mountain years and years ago in South Africa. And I'd be dreaming about the struggle and freedom in South Africa, and bang, you know, I'd crack my nut on an overhang and have that same sort of concussed sense. The only difference was this time the sense of concussion just didn't go away. The darkness stayed with me. And then I felt arms pulling me, and I realized this was something awful and threatening and ominous and directed at me. And I felt I was being kidnapped. And I can recall shouting out, leave me, leave me. I'd rather die here, something to that effect. And doing it in English, which is my mother tongue as a South African, and in Portuguese, which is the most widely spoken language in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, where I was working at the time. And I can also recall, in a half kind of a way, doing so, shouting out, but in a sort of polite way, because after all, I was a middle-aged lawyer in a public place, and I felt that I mustn't make too much noise. These are kind of half memories, half sensations, and then fading out completely, and being a little bit angry, everybody around me talking earnestly, energetically, tensely, but about me as though I was an object and not to me as though I was a person. Well, and then once more total darkness, and then a voice coming through, very gentle and very kind voice, saying, Albi, this is Eva Garrido, you're in the Maputo Central Hospital, and we're going to operate, and you have to face the future with courage. And I was so happy just to hear somebody speaking to me and hear a good voice and to discover where I was. And then I sort of mumbled, still in the darkness, what happened, and a voice said to me, car bomb. And then I just remember like fainting, but fainting in a state of bliss, of euphoria, because I knew I'd survived, that I was okay.
You don't really remember all that much about what actually happened at the time, but you've asked friends who were following the news to help you reconstruct what happened. How much do you know now, and do you know who was behind the assassination attempt?
Well, this is very strange, because I didn't want to know for about 2 months. I didn't want anybody to tell me. It was enough that I'd survived. But subsequently, I saw it on a movie. There were two people with video cameras nearby. I saw it on photograph. I can't bear to look at those pictures. And then people like pieced together what had happened, and it appears that a car, my car was mined with a bomb that exploded as I was opening the door. I was on my way to the beach, and that seems pretty clear. And at one stage, loads and loads of people were saying they saved my life. And I would bump into people in Maputo, and they would tell me they dragged me away, and I just didn't recognize anybody. And now it's turned around a bit, and people are claiming we tried to kill him. And I've heard this from at least two different sources, as though they get some kind of pride in saying we were the ones. One was a black Angolan working for South African military who's been in custody in Maputo, and the other is a white South African lieutenant who belonged to the hit squad and gave a very extensive interview to South African press, claiming with great professional pride about how they, well, it's true that they didn't actually manage to kill me, but they did manage to get rid of my arm, and it was a highly professional job done by one of their top operatives, and he was indignant at the fact that this operative wasn't paid the full rate for the job, and he felt that this was most unfair.
So no one has been officially convicted of the assassination attempt?
No. And, you know, in a funny way, it doesn't even interest me very much to lock somebody up for this. Won't give me my arm back. It won't make South Africa a better place. But what is important is for the truth to come out, for people to know what happened. I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for other victims of police brutality and violence. But I know I feel very, very strongly in my whole being that if we just do the same to them as they've done to us, well, what's it all about? But if the truth comes out and we can stop this kind of behavior in future, and if these hit squads are disbanded, and if we can get a democracy in South Africa, then it's all worthwhile. And that is very, very healing.
My guest is Albie Sachs, and he's a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Study Center in London. He's written a memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt, and it's called Running to Maputo. When did you join the ANC?
I seem to have been born into it, but I think, in fact, I became actively involved as a student age 17.
And what year was that?
About 1952.
And how did you get involved?
When I got involved, it seemed the most natural thing in the world. It was through a student group. There was a lot of sort of accidental meetings, but I'd grown up in quite a politicized home. My father was a trade unionist. My mother was politically active. So in that sense, I grew up in an anti-racist environment. But what was important was discovering these things for myself, and that I did with a crowd of young people, black and white, at university. And once I got in, it just seemed the most natural thing in the world.
What's your role in the ANC now?
My main work is on the Constitutional Committee. It's wonderful work. It's marvelous. We are the founding fathers and the founding mothers, if you like, of our constitution. We're doing it very consciously. There are a lot of us, and we're very anxious to get as many people, non-lawyers, involved as possible in different ways. But we have a key role in terms of propositions, of formulations. We've got a super team, a very, very strong team of South African lawyers, either members of the ANC or very close to the ANC, and we're working flat out now in making, if you like, drafts of drafts for the constitution. That's my main work. I've also landed in some very hot debates on culture in the new South Africa. I wrote a paper for the ANC for an internal debate, which was subsequently released to the press, and that's provoked a tremendous discussion debate in South Africa. And I find I'm called upon constantly to speak about that.
Give me a sense of what you've called for that's so controversial.
Well, I said, although I'm totally against censorship of any kind, I would like to ban the statement that art is a weapon of struggle from our movement for 5 years. And I said, I'm somebody who's been saying this for the last 25 years. Let me explain why I feel that statement ought to be banned. And so the paper continues in that vein.
And why should it be banned?
Because it becomes a substitute for really facing up to transforming culture in South Africa. People just come out with it as a sort of incantation, as a slogan, and it diminishes art and it diminishes the struggle. It makes it seem as though art is something you haul onto the stage from time to time to liven up a meeting, when in fact culture really is who are we? We know where South Africa is, we don't know what it is, we don't know what it means to be a South African. And it's people in culture, in music, in dance, in poetry, in song, in painting, in film, in radio, who tell us what this thing is to be a South African, the thing that we're struggling for. And if we impose upon that tremendous enterprise a few rather banal slogans, we're not going to get anywhere. So the idea is not to separate politics from art, because you can't do it, but to allow the politics to come in a natural way for people who are already engaged in the struggle, who are spontaneously or by conviction anti-racist, but to be more daring, to take more risks, to explore more, not to be scared of contradictions, ambiguity, fun, tragedy, humor, and to get out of this very solemn way of presenting political art that most of us have been, and certainly I have been, guilty of in the past.
You just returned from South Africa. Was this your first time back since your exile?
No, it was my first time back since my first time back. I went back, in fact, in May, June. That was my first time, my return after 24 years. It was an absolutely glorious return. I saw myself on American television afterwards, and it wasn't myself. This was a lunatic, somebody with shining mad eyes and a gaping mouth. And that's exactly how I felt at the time. It was just wonderful.
What impressions did you return with from your last trip? And what was the purpose of your trip?
The purpose was to go back. the first time, just to feel the soil under my feet, to meet the people, to have that sense of joy and personal victory, if you like, of triumph, of achievement. This is what we've been fighting for, this is what we had achieved. Hundreds of meetings, non-stop, TV cameras following me around. It was a nice feeling to feel welcome in my own country. But also I wanted to see with my own eyes what was it like, the South Africa I'd been talking about and urging people to impose sanctions against. What was it actually like to be there, to see the people? And the emotion was tremendous. I spoke mainly on university campuses, and I said, please, you know, just a nice, quiet exchange of views. And people said, well, you might want that. The students are not going to allow it. There was singing, there was dancing, there was vivas, viva Albie Sachs, viva, almost like too much. But it was very warm. And I particularly enjoyed visits to Afrikaans universities, because these had been absolute citadels of racist, fascist, nationalist thinking. And the glow of the reception, the enthusiasm with which people there received me, was something more than just personal. This was like heart meeting heart. This was a sense of historic encounter, of tremendous achievement. And so I came away, I almost didn't have to fly back to London, you know, I could have just flapped my 1.5 arms and I would have arrived.
The trip that you're describing, was that your first trip or your second trip that you've just described?
That was the first one. The second one, I've just returned, just before giving this interview, and I'm still glowing because it was a continuation of the first with perhaps a little less of the madness. And what was interesting was I noticed a lot of progress in the past couple of months, and even the short time that I'd been away. Things are moving forward in South Africa. There's tremendous amount of bloodletting. A lot of people are playing their last cards, trying to sabotage the whole agreement, to say, as it were, I kill, therefore I am. I must be recognized at the negotiating table. And it's not even necessary to do that, because there will be place at the negotiations for everybody. So that's all very bitter. But side by side with the bitterness, and I think a much stronger force, is the force for renovation and change, and people beginning to develop a new outlook. Apartheid is still there. It's a very divided society. It's a very unequal society and a very racist society. But what has changed is the outlook of people. And people, black people, are discriminated against, but you sense they are not oppressed in the way they were when I left South Africa. There's a sense of burgeoning freedom, a sense of achievement. And a lot of whites I met felt a thrill of release from the shame of being associated with apartheid, an enthusiasm that they can use their talents and their skills in a creative way. Many other whites are uncertain, they're unsure, they're nervous, but there's an openness that we never had before in South Africa.
Albie Sachs, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your trip to South Africa from which you just returned. And my guest is Albie Sachs. He's a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Studies Center in London. He's just written a memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt on his life in 1988. The memoir is called Running to Maputo. This is Fresh Air. Albie Sachs is my guest. This has been a very bloody last few weeks in South Africa because of the fighting between Zulus and Xhosas, or Zulus and members of the ANC. More than 550 people have been killed since August 12th. I think most Americans find this fighting very confusing, and I was wondering what explanation you could offer to us to help us understand what's happening.
Yes, it seems pretty clear that the whole thing has been orchestrated by groups inside and outside the police who want to sabotage the peace process, who are not happy with the way FW de Klerk is moving, and who are playing, as it were, their last card, which is the racist pogrom-type card. And they utilizing the ambition of some of the Zulu leaders as the basis. Some false pamphlets were issued, and there's quite a lot of documentation coming out explaining all this. It's very tragic, it's very bitter, and the fact is that this instigated violence that received a lot of police protection can only function because the tensions are already there. So we have to deal with the immediate problem, we also have to deal with the tensions. A lot of it is related to the whole migrant labor system, people living together, hundreds of men, living together in hostels. A lot of factors come together. But a lot of progress has been made to start the process of seriously settling the whole problem of Inkatha, which is really at the foundation of all of this. And I think, despite the terrible carnage of the past few weeks, the peace process is not going to be diverted, and basic democracy will be introduced in South Africa.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how it's felt over the years to be a white member of the African National Congress.
I've really felt myself really to be Albie in the ANC, and it's very rare the whiteness as such crops up. But I remember once when it did, it was at a funeral of a colleague and comrade friend of ours, Eddie Weinberg, a photographer, at a memorial meeting, and one of our African black comrades said, and Ellie was always willing to eat with us, and he made great sacrifices to be in the struggle with us. And I was the next speaker, and I changed what I'd prepared to say, and I said, I just want to say that I'm sure Ellie would have rejected the idea that he was making sacrifices, that it was an honor and a joy to be in the liberation struggle. And that's the way I felt. The cultural question is always with us. There are always things to learn. The race question never goes away, even in the best of movements, and I think we are one of the best of movements. But it's basically been a very positive experience, and I think I can say a wonderful life.
I know in the American Civil Rights Movement, there was a point, for instance, when SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, asked its white members to leave, and this was in part because of the feeling that whites would end up in leadership positions and end up in some ways patronizing the black members. And in order for blacks to really have self-determination within the civil rights movement, there'd have to be a period in which whites were not officially included in the membership of certain groups. Was there ever talk of such a thing in the ANC, or do you think that South Africa was in a very different kind of situation?
We moved in exactly the opposite direction. When I started off, I was in a separate organization for white supporters of the ANC. And progressively, we became integrated into the ANC. It was a question of a process evolving. And when you look at our leadership, I mean, who's going to patronize Nelson Mandela? Who's going to patronize Oliver Tambo? These are great leaders of world stature. We're extremely proud of them. They are happy to work with all South African patriots who believe in democracy in South Africa. And I think maybe what makes a big difference in South Africa is you have a very large, very confident, strong black majority in the society and a white minority. And the black majority have shown enormous generosity in a way that the white majority haven't shown in the United States. And this somehow makes it much easier for human relationships to emerge and evolve in the context of the ANC.
When you were living in South Africa as a lawyer, you spent time defending anti-apartheid activists. Did you always feel that the courts and the legal system was stacked against you? Was it possible to ever win?
Well, we measured winning by... At first, we actually won in the 50s when I started. We actually won. We got our clients off. But after Sharpeville, 1960, the banning of the organizations, everything going underground, we just had to try and manage loss and reduce. If somebody didn't get the death sentence, that was a victory. If somebody was sentenced to 15 years rather than 25 years, that was a victory. If we could expose a little bit of torture, I mean, there was a lot of torture, but give a little exposure to it, that was a breakthrough. And we were really using the tiny little crevices available in the legal system to defend people as much as possible and to expose as much as possible. Now, of course, we're thinking about a complete transformation of the legal system using what was good there, and there were a lot of very profoundly good features in the South African legal system, but detaching them from the defense of apartheid, from the whole racist structures. To this day, there are still only white judges in South Africa. And, of course, making the law anti-racist and having a new constitution. So if anybody's looking for a good job, their good job's going for good judges in South Africa.
Have you seen Nelson Mandela since his release from prison?
Yes, I've seen him twice, briefly. And, of course, they were quite emotional encounters.
You used an alias when you were recovering in a London hospital from the assassination attempt on your life. When did you start using your name again and feeling comfortable about letting people know where you were?
You know, the alias was adopted by the London hospital that didn't want to give its name away.
Oh, because they were afraid that they would be vulnerable too?
Possibly. And it created enormous confusion in records, and the psychiatrist who came to see me was totally against it. I said, I'm also totally against it. So I never really used the alias there. It was just really for record purposes. Afterwards, when I came out of hospital, I acted in a kind of clandestine way, but the purpose wasn't to keep my enemies from getting at me. It was to keep my friends from reaching me. It was just too much. There were too many people. I had no privacy. There was just so much love, like pouring in, and so many people wanting to see me that I was just becoming destabilized. So I went into hiding from my friends. I've come out again.
Do you have any fear of another attempt on your life?
No. You know, I feel I'm indestructible. It's a strange kind of feeling, but I sort of don't care. And one of the things was I went back to Maputo as soon as possible, 7 months after the bomb. I deliberately went back to confront the scene of the explosion. And I just knew that psychologically this would lift the dread, and it did. And I'm so thrilled with what's happening in South Africa, and I'm so happy with my own recovery, and so happy to be back. And, of course, it's marvelous having the book coming out, and it's been, so far, it seems to be very well received, and people like it, and so on, that I'm just feeling, what more can they do to me?
Do you have any plans on returning to South Africa to live?
Yes, I'm definitely returning. It's a question of finding a place, and I know what I want. I want to be able to hear the sea when I wake up in the morning and when I go to sleep at night. And I'm taking steps to find that place.
Albie Sachs, I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Albie Sachs is a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Study Center in London. His new memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt on his life is called Running to Maputo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Porky Pig took their music cues from Carl Stalling. Stalling composed and arranged the music for Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. Coming up, we meet the producers of a new recording of Stalling's cartoon music. Also, who would you pick to enter the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year? Rock historian Ed Ward tells us how he's casting his ballot. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Pump Up the Volume. It stars Christian Slater as a high school student with his own radio station. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. More than 400 U.S. and British citizens have been evacuated from Iraq and Kuwait, the largest group of hostages since Iraq said that women and children were free to leave. The evacuees had been trapped in Kuwait since Iraqi forces overran the country earlier that last month, and they described a scene of chaos and terror. More from NPR's Tom Gelton in Amman.
The British citizens traveled overland from Kuwait to Iraq earlier this week. They finally flew out to Amman and then on to London today after waiting several days for exit visas in Baghdad. The Americans, 169 women and children and two men, flew from Kuwait this morning to Baghdad and then on to Amman, where they'll spend the night before returning to the United States. Many of the women had left their husbands behind in Kuwait, and they fought tears as they told of their fears that they may never see them again. Iraqi troops, they said, are searching house to house for Western men and taking away any they find, presumably to serve as human shields at strategic installations. Many of the women said they'd been in hiding since the Iraqi invasion. Several reported that all semblance of law and order has disappeared in Kuwait, with Iraqi troops looting stores, raiding homes, and stealing cars. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Tom Gelton.
While Iraqi officials have been allowing American women and children to return to the United States, American men continue to be rounded up. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
More than 160 American women and children were allowed to go to Jordan today, and a similar charter flight is scheduled for tomorrow. But American men continue to be targets of the Iraqis. Almost 90 Americans have been rounded up since the August 2nd Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The latest was picked up in Kuwait on Thursday with his non-American wife and taken to Baghdad. Earlier this week, an Iraqi soldier shot and wounded an American as he was trying to escape out of a window at his apartment in Kuwait. There have been reports that the Americans are being used as human shields at military or industrial installations to deter an American military attack against Iraq. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Japan and South Korea now say that they will join Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and help pay for the massive military buildup in the Persian Gulf area. U.S. officials are seeking more than $25 billion in aid to help cover the cost of the U.S. troop deployment and for economic aid for countries hurt by the U.N.-sponsored trade embargo against Iraq. President Bush is leaving this evening for a weekend summit meeting with Soviet leader Gorbachev. The Sunday summit in Helsinki will deal with the Persian Gulf crisis. Mr. Bush will head back to Washington after the meeting and will speak before a joint session of Congress Tuesday night. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 23 points to close at 2,619.55 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, some great cartoon music without the cartoons. But first. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward is engaged in an annual ritual that he says is about as much fun as going back to school after summer vacation. He's voting for inductees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's got to get his ballot back to the Hall of Fame Foundation in a few days. Since most of us don't get to vote, Ed's going to take us to the ballot box as he decides.
There are 15 candidates for induction this year, and I have to choose 8 of them. In alphabetical order, we have Laverne Baker, Bobby Blue Bland, The Byrds, Johnny Cash, Duane Eddy, John Lee Hooker, The Impressions, Elmore James, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, The Moonglows, Wilson Pickett, Jimmy Reed, Ike and Tina Turner, Gene Vincent, and The Yardbirds. The Foundation was also kind enough to send along a tape of the most obvious recordings by each of these people for the benefit of the many voters whose memories don't go back to John Lee Hooker's 1949 recording of Boogie Chillin' or Elmore James' 1952 hit Dust My Broom. Of course, there's a problem with this ballot. In the Baseball Hall of Fame selection process, sports writers who specialize in baseball make the nominations and do the voting. But the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is, I think, left up to the music industry at large. If it were up to just professional rock and roll historians, it would be one thing, but there really aren't enough of us for it to look good on paper. Unfortunately, though, the music industry is known for its short and selective memory. It's as unlikely to remember Greg Kinn or Pat Benatar as it is to remember Laverne Baker or Gene Vincent. And Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot sold a lot more records than Gene Vincent's Bebopalula. So whoever made up these nominations went for the most obvious names within the parameters of the rules, which allow anybody whose debut occurred 25 or more years ago to be eligible. I think it's arguable that the people who really did build rock and roll, who made it what it became, are only slightly represented in this Hall of Fame, and some of the ones who are may be there for reasons other than the reasons they should be there. Take Ike Turner, who's a nominee this year with Tina. People who vote for them will probably do so on the basis of records like Fool in Love, and they'd be amazed to learn that Ike Turner has a career that stretches back to well before he even met Annie Mae Bullock, whom he renamed Tina. Ike was the guy who made B.B. King's first records, Howlin' Wolf's first records, and nearly every other hit that came out of Memphis in the early 50s. He was also responsible for Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston, which many consider the first real rock and roll record. There are also names on the list whom I don't think belong there. Duane Eddy? For all those twangy guitar instrumentals? I wouldn't vote for him until guitar kings like Loman Pauling, Merle Travis, Hubert Sumlin, Luther Perkins, Freddie King, and Dick Dale are in. And while country music is an integral component of early rock and roll, I think Wanda Jackson, the Collins Kids, Johnny Horton, Little Jimmy Dickens, and Sonny Burgess, to name just a few, have priority over Johnny Cash, much as I admire him, and I do, deeply. Then comes the thorny debate. Should one great record qualify you? This question arises for two of this year's nominees. Elmore James recorded Dust My Broom over and over, with different titles and lyrics. Of course, people continued to buy it, so I guess he'll pass inspection here. But Frankie Lyman, no matter how tragic and ready for prime time his rise and fall might be, made one good record, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, and followed it up with one mediocre release after another. The records he made after he left the teenagers and went solo are even worse. No, he's off the list. I wonder how I'd feel about a one-hit wonder like Suzanne and the Band-Aids, whose You May Never Know is a big cult hit among some, or Howard Tate, whose Look at Granny Run Run knocked me out in 1967 amidst heavy competition. Not that we have to worry about those two getting nominated. Okay, with Cash, Eddy, and Lyman eliminated, I've still got to X out four more. Let's face it, the Obscuros need my vote. So I'm dumping the Byrds, the Yardbirds, John Lee Hooker, he had a hit this year, so lots of people know who he is, no offense, John Lee, and Wilson Pickett, who likewise needs no help. Mind you, all of these folks deserve to be in, but they kick you out of the nomination after a few years, and since Ruth Brown never made it, I've got to help out Laverne Baker, the Moonglows, and Gene Vincent before they're disqualified. So, with votes weighted in order of preference, there's 1, 2, and 3. 4 and 5 will be Elmore James and Jimmy Reed, who are far from my favorite blues men, but also need help. 6 is The Impressions, with a get-well card for Curtis Mayfield thrown in. 7 is Bobby Bland, who again isn't really a rock and roll performer, but who's had some pop chart success. And finally, Ike and Tina, as much for Ike as for his ex-wife. Well, that's it for another year, I suppose. The question still remains if there's ever going to physically be a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland or anywhere else, since the whole thing seems to have been mired in scandal since it was announced. And of course, there's another question, equally important. Will it make any difference? Or will it just be yet another tedious exercise in nostalgia, like the awful rock and roll circus Madame Tussauds has erected in London's Piccadilly? Or does any of this really matter? After all, when it comes right down to it, we either love rock and roll or it doesn't matter all that much. If we love it, don't we have our own personal Rock and Roll Hall of Fame sitting on the shelves over by the stereo? And don't we each go through a nomination and selection process for it every time we buy a record? Instead of spending $1,000 to attend this year's Hall of Fame dinner, I'd rather spend $10 on something I really want to listen to. And even if I just send out for a pizza, the food will be better, too.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. And he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Carl Stalling composed the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies for the Warner Brothers cartoons. Some people might dismiss his work as just cartoon music, but there are those who rank the late composer as a genius and think it's time his music stood alone. Carl Stalling's music is being revived on a new CD coming out this month on Warner Records. It's called The Carl Stalling Project. Stalling scored about 600 Warner Brothers cartoons between 1936 and 1958. Before that, he worked for Walt Disney on early Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony cartoons. The Carl Stalling Project is produced by Greg Ford and Hal Wilner. Ford is a writer and director at Warner Cartoons and co-producer of two new Daffy Duck cartoons. Hal Wilner is best known for the tribute albums he's produced, using contemporary musicians to reinterpret the music of composers like Thelonious Monk, Kurt Weill, and Nino Rota. I asked Ford and Wilner why they wanted to separate Stalling's music from the cartoons.
It sounds so beautiful in itself. It's actually, you know, almost more exciting, right? hearing it without seeing the cartoon imagery.
Well, actually approaching it like any other movie composer. I mean, you wouldn't want to have the soundtrack to Casablanca with the dialogue, or so we're just putting him in the same realm as Max Steiner or Bernard Herrmann, and so his music is just as important.
Do you think of there being a certain kind of music, certain style of music that Stalling virtually created?
Yeah, I guess like the montage, really. In music, just using every type. It would change every few seconds, from like going to a solo flute to a tango to something you've heard before.
Yeah, every second he'd be underscoring a different kind of mood or a change in the action. And in that sense, it's very postmodern, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the funny thing is, at the time, it was servicing, you know, the cartoon imagery and... you know, where it was perfectly natural to go to from some classical theme to some jazz theme to some just synchronized original theme that he did, and yeah, it was completely different types of music. But you know, he thought nothing of making those changes, and at the time was probably regarded as like being musically disrespectful. You hear it now, it's like. It seems like way, way ahead of its time.
Well, so those fast chase themes, I mean, you've never heard anything like that before. So it was purely his own.
Have a couple of examples of Stalling rehearsing the orchestra.
No, that's the recording. They're actually not rehearsing. Taking takes.
Yeah, it's taking takes.
Right, okay,
you hear some of the ones they didn't use.
Tell me why you wanted to include the different takes.
Well, it was important, I think, to see how this music was recorded. I mean, the opening of the record, which has four takes of that short theme from Putty Tat Trouble. I mean, it's amazing to hear that. I mean, no one ever thinks of this music as something that actually gets done with an orchestra, with real people and real musicians. And I thought that brought it to a human level, which a lot of people don't hear when they hear this music.
Yeah, I think it's shocking to listen to it and hear all the work that went into it to get a perfect sync or a perfect sound for the cues. And it really is something people take for granted and don't even think of as being done by human beings.
And actually to hear some of the musicians complaining that they have to do it again, hearing, you know, Bill Franklin's annoying voice. You know, I mean, I think it's great to hear it that way.
All right, here we go, production number 1171. Putty That Trouble, part 6. What's more?
I used to play a lot of early jazz on the radio, jazz from the 20s and 30s, and people would inevitably say to me, hey, I really like that stuff, cartoon music. And I'd get really annoyed because it would just annoy me that people would think that Fletcher Henderson or Armstrong was cartoon music. Well, but it occurs
but
to me
were.
They were probably...
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the Stalling scores go... Stalling took it to another place, but if you look at a lot of the cartoons from other studios, they used a lot of that music. Mm-hmm. I mean, Fleischer, whoever, I mean, used a lot of Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington to score their films.
No, the Fleischer stuff was really the most musically interesting place for me before Stalling started working at Warner's. But they had an in with the soundy department at Paramount, I guess. And, you know, if there was a little piece of Cab Calloway...
They used a lot of those records as foundations for their cartoons.
Exactly.
Tell me how you decided to arrange the music on the record. I mean, you have several things that are like little montages of music from different cartoons built around a theme.
Yeah, well, that all started out, I mean, the idea of this record came 6 years ago, so a lot of ideas changed through the time. And when we finally got together to put the record together, we decided it'd be best to have montages from different periods because, I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of cartoons. We're dealing with maybe 70 minutes we can work with. So I thought it'd be interesting to go from complete cartoon scores to montages, say, from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, to show how he evolved. And from that, different themes came up, like a montage of themes for Bugs Bunny, a montage of themes he composed for jungle scenes, and it grew from there.
This is a compilation of films, of cues that Stalling would always use for jungle themes, the most famous of which is this little Fingal's Cave Overture cue that Stalling would always associate with the walk of a particular character, this like weird-looking minor bird that Chuck Jones created.
Yeah, when I would listen to a lot of these cartoons, those jungle themes took me back more than any of the others as to what I remembered as a kid.
Exhausting to listen to all of this, and I say exhausting because so much of the music is so so much in short little bites,
and
it keeps
intense,
changing back
yeah.
and forth.
I'm glad that you said that because most people say this must have been fun. Yeah. I want to just kill them.
Very intense.
Of course, we waited to the last minute to put it together. So I basically listened to over 200 scores over 4 days.
Yeah, I felt like I was indoctrinating him into a cult or something. You know? I was like depriving him of sleep and like, hear this. It's like, you know, I felt guilty after a while.
How did you both get together on this project?
Well, just through that TV special. It was, I think, Lauren Michaels produced CBS special. Yeah, I'd worked for Saturday Night Live for years, so they hired me for the music, and so we met there, and then we continued our relationship through Greg and Terry's shorts.
What was the special you're talking about?
It had one of these funny executive titles where they keep adding words. It's like, it was called, let's see if I can remember, The Bugs Bunny. It's like an incantation. The Bugs Bunny Looney Tunes All-Star 50th Anniversary something.
Amen.
Bless you.
Yeah, and zany child. Gags.
With wacky comedy.
So, Greg, are you continuing to make more cartoons?
Yes, we after an absence of about a year, yes, we're back in production. Two shorts I'm really interested in. One is based on the premise of like an animation outtake reel, where you the characters you see the something done straight first, and then you see like the outtakes. You know, it's like in the normal version, they're all smiling and happy. It's sort of like what the merchandising people would like the characters to be like, and then in the outtakes they're more like themselves. They're swearing at each other and everything else. And then the other cartoon is called Invasion of the Bunny Snatchers, which is a parable about the characters being turned into limited animation characters.
That sounds great. So their lips will move and nothing else.
Yeah. And sometimes out of register, the mouth will sort of fly out of the outline of the character by mistake.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. Okay, well, I guess that's all, folks. Thanks a lot to you both for talking with us.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Greg Ford and Hal Wilner produced the new record, The Carl Stalling Project, coming out later this month on Warner Records. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what stories do you have from the Persian Gulf?
We have some very grisly tales told by the women who've come out of Kuwait, the Americans who've arrived now in Amman, Jordan. Also, news that some of the terrorists who'd been jailed in Kuwait may have already been released to Iran. Also, on this evening's program, we have a special profile by NPR's Nina Totenberg of Judge David Souter, President Bush's nominee to fill the Supreme Court vacancy created by Justice Brennan's resignation, and recalling on this day of his death, A.J.P. Taylor, one of the most renowned British historians of our times.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pump Up the Volume is a new movie about teenagers and the power of radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
During the early 80s, movies about high school life were the bane of every grown-up filmgoer's existence. But now that the flood of teen movie sludge has slowed to a trickle, I have to admit there's a certain kind of high school picture I've always liked. The kind I think of as the youth anthem. I'm talking about movies like Rebel Without a Cause, and If, and The Wild One. The kind of movies that stir kids up and make them feel like bucking mindless authority, kicking out the jams, breathing free. Youth anthems are few and far between these days, maybe because most of us are so afraid of the violence that can result when kids' anarchic energies are turned loose. But an invigorating youth anthem like Pump Up the Volume can make you feel young and crazy and blissful again. It's the perfect antidote to such celebrations of classroom authoritarianism as Stand and Deliver and Lean on Me. Pump Up the Volume is about Mark, the new kid at Hubert Humphrey High School in Paradise Hills, Arizona. By day, he's stooped and bespectacled, and so shy he can barely get a word out. But at night, he steals into his family's basement, where he turns on the ham radio equipment his parents gave him and becomes Hard Harry, the wild man DJ of his own pirate radio station. Between cuts from Ice-T and the Descendants, and an old fogey named Leonard Cohen, Hard Harry pours out his pain and his sexual fantasies and his exhortations to rebellion. In this scene, we hear him as he really sounds, but we also hear him as his fans do, through a device he uses to make his voice unrecognizable.
Doesn't this blend of blindness and blandness want to make you do something crazy? Then why not do something crazy? It makes a hell of a lot more sense than blowing your brains out.
You know, go nuts, go crazy, get creative. You got problems? You just chuck them, nuke them.
They think you're moody. Make them think you're crazy. Make them think you might snap. They think you got attitude. You show them some real attitude.
Ah, I mean, go nuts.
Get crazy. Hey, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Christian Slater, who plays the pirate DJ, has taken a certain amount of abuse, some of it deserved, for being a callow Jack Nicholson imitator. But in Pump Up the Volume, he vindicates himself. He moves effortlessly from shy Mark to hard Harry and back, and his performance brims with irony and wit. Which is fortunate, because the screenplay by the film's director, Alan Moyle, is about how Harry's radio show inspires the kids to cut loose and question all those pep rally values. And as the kids throw off the chains of high school conformity, the movie's tone teeters precariously between bracing irreverence and maudlin preachiness. Luckily, Slater builds a wink into even his drippiest lines, and so do a lot of the other actors, especially Samantha Mathis, who's wonderful as the girl who brings him out of his shell. Pump Up the Volume isn't powerful and moving the way it wants to be, but it is exhilarating, and not just for teenagers. If you're an adult who's gotten used to thinking of kids as that dangerous subspecies which takes drugs, carries Uzis, and doesn't know where Mexico is, well, Pump Up the Volume can put you in an awfully forgiving mood.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic George Carlin talks about those seven dirty words you still can't say on the radio. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thinks of some of the new fall sitcoms. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.